I want to see science serve a useful purpose to improve the standard of living for all people.
Why is anyone fighting food advance? A very small percentage of the world's population is fortunate enough to have the luxury of turning down food.
We've arranged a society based on science and technology in which nobody understands anything about science and technology.
You can't build a peaceful world on empty stomachs and human misery.
You're listening to Talking Biotech, a weekly podcast illuminating issues in agricultural and medical biotechnology. Your questions and concerns are addressed using a science-based approach with the goal of driving discovery to application with communication. Now here's your host, Dr. Kevin Folta.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to the Talking Biotech podcast, the weekly podcast where we discuss contemporary issues in science and technology with a focus on biotechnology and the innovations that can help people and help the planet. I'm Kevin Folta, and today we'll be talking about Terminator seeds. Now, anyone who's taken the time to talk to the public about biotechnology hears many different reasons for why people are opposed to the use of such technologies. And one of the reasons that is frequently discussed is, well, I'm against the Terminator technology. And you say, what is that? Well, they say, well, it's the technology that puts genes for sterility in the plants that can spread to all plants and destroy all the food on the planet. And then we don't have any. And lots of problems with that argument. Mostly that it's, well, I won't say if it's true or false. We'll leave that for the second half of today's podcast. but even experts, well, in quote experts, folks like Vandana Shiva. Vandana Shiva, she will speak openly about Terminator technology and how these are employed strategies that the companies are using to control seeds and hurt farmers and limit seed choice for farmers. And today we'll talk with Dr. Mel Oliver. And Dr. Mel Oliver is a scientist with the USDA who actually back in the 1990s conceived of these technologies and tells you exactly what they were and how much they were implemented. And when you hear the backstory behind this and then the whole story with respect to how the technology was actually used, it's a welcome lesson and myth-busting session that I think you'll really enjoy. But first, I wanted to introduce you to something that I found really heartwarming and outstanding when we think about the future of technology and mostly the people who will be using it. I had an invitation from Oak Leaf High School in near Jacksonville, Florida, to attend a white coat ceremony. So like they do for doctors who receive their degrees or nurses, they have a white coat ceremony where the students get a lab coat after passing a certificate program in biotechnology. And so they learn some fundamental nuts and bolts that really prepare them to be able to work in a laboratory effectively. It's a really outstanding program, and it's awesome that they have the tools and resources to do this. And I was really honored to be able to talk to the students, give them a little bit of a talk. Maybe we'll air parts of it here later. But the basic idea is that when students are preparing for a future in biotechnology, they have to pack a suitcase for a journey where they don't know where they're going or what they'll do when they get there. How do you do that? And the thesis of my discussion was you better have a bag with plenty of different tools. And so emphasize not only the hard sciences like physics and chemistry, a broad background across biology, but certainly understanding psychology and sociology if you're going to know how your technologies will apply and how people will think about them. But then also you better have good communication skills, both written and spoken. And basically telling students that, you know, it's not the beginning of the end, it's the end of the beginning. and that earning a certificate in a biotech program puts them at a cutting edge, but a cutting edge that will always be moving and changing, and a cutting edge that will constantly need them to retool and also diversify their training in order to be competitive in tomorrow's, which will be a very crowded job market. So over the next few minutes, I'd like you to listen to the interviews I had with several students. And when you listen to the students in this program, and you listen to their ideas and aspirations, how articulate they are, and how some of them even have it figured out pretty well, what they hope to be doing, I think you find it exciting, you find it optimistic, and in times when we get a little depressed about the things we read on the internet and how can this be happening, how can people be so wrong, listen to these kids, young adults, whatever they are, and you realize that maybe something is really right with the world.
Well, hi, this is Kevin, and we're at Oak Leaf High School in Orange Park, Florida, where we just were at the lab coat ceremony, which gave the lab coat to the next generation of students that were just trained here in biotechnology. And I'm with one of the students now, and maybe you could tell me a little bit about the program and what you learned here during your time in the program.
This program offers a very unique look into agriculture. A lot of the other agriculture programs within the state of Florida are just general agriculture, and this program offers a whole nother look at a different side of agriculture. We know that agriculture is so vast and has so many different opportunities and job fields and whatnot. So this gives students an opportunity to learn about the biotechnology side of it and really how biotechnology is the future of agriculture and how it's going to impact the future. And this specific lab coating ceremony gives students the chance to recognize their achievements within the classroom and their education thus far in the biotech program.
Yeah, and I should make it clear, you are a student in the program because you sound like a teacher in the program. But what were the best things you learned? What were your favorite parts of the course?
Overall, I would say the diversity of it. As I said before, coming in, I kind of knew the basics of production agriculture. I didn't know how much science was put into it and how much research is put into it, how much development is put into it. And not only that, but the development that is continuing and that will always need that science aspect of it for agriculture. So constantly learning and looking at it through more of a science eyes than more of a production eyes per se was definitely my favorite part of the program.
Okay, and what's next for you as you go forward?
Right now, there are two classes that the biotech, or that our academy offers besides biotechnology. We have ag leadership and we have ag business. And I was enrolled in the ag business class last year, and so I'm looking to major in agribusiness at the University of Florida or Texas A&M.
All right, two good choices there. Now, do you come from an agriculture background?
I do not. I actually grew up in South Texas, and I moved to Florida. My dad is in the military. And I came here in about sixth grade, and I had no agriculture background whatsoever. And I enrolled in my first agriculture education class in seventh grade because it sounded interesting. And I think that's one of the great things that this program offers, is it allows students who don't come from an agriculture background the opportunity to see the importance of agriculture and to become agriculture advocates themselves.
Awesome. Well, if you end up at University of Florida, stick your head in the door and let's continue the conversation, okay?
Yes,
very nice to meet you.
Yes, sir.
And I'm standing here with another student who is here in the biotech program, or at least has passed through the biotech program, who's involved with FFA here in Florida. And can you tell me a little bit about what you really enjoyed about the biotechnology aspect of the program?
Well, I love science. It's my passion, and through this program, I've gotten to be hands-on in a lab and experience some of the things that I'll be doing in the future. I've gotten to learn how to conduct ELISA testing and my basic lab procedures and stuff. So it's been a really great program for me, and through the certification process, where I now have my biotechnology certification, I'm now able to work in a lab and hopefully work in a lab in UF.
In UF? I know a guy who's got a lab at UF you could work in. So what is your long-term vision, like maybe 10 years longer?
Well, I hope to get my PhD and become a doctor. I want to specialize in internal medicine for the Navy. Medicine's been a passion for me, as well as science, as it's a part of it. And I'm really excited to hopefully get to work in UF and use what I've learned in biotech and incorporate it into my future studies.
Wow, that's really amazing. Seems like you've got it all planned out already. You want to do medicine in the Navy. What do you think about the combination of biotechnology and medicine? Like, are there ways that you think that maybe in 10 years we'll be maybe tailoring medicine more based upon DNA and what we know about a person's genetics?
As of right now, we've already come so far and already started to conduct studies and stuff where that DNA is where they're using DNA to incorporate in medicine. So I believe that biotechnology and its part in medicine, it'll go further within the next 10 years. I hope to have a part in that, actually.
Okay. Oh, that's really cool. So I have to say it again. You are a high school student now, right?
Yes.
Okay, so you're not a professional in science yet or from some university, right?
Not yet, but I will be.
Oh, you make me happy. Okay. Very good. Thank you very much for your time.
I
appreciate
it.
Very nice. So I'm here with another student who just got her lab coat today. Did very well. You did a wonderful job walking across the stage there. And so can you tell me a little bit about your favorite part of the program?
I think my favorite part is that we're preparing for the future. Like, for example, biotechnology and more emerging technology of agriculture. And that's what I like about it.
And where would you like to see what you learned applied? Like, where would you like to see it really make a difference?
For me, since in a few years, I want to go in a career in science, particularly in genomics. So that's why this program will help me prepare for that future, since it's plant biotechnology.
Yeah, that is a very important part of the underlying of the discipline. And so what do you imagine you'll be doing, say, in 10 years or 20 years?
Oh, that's easy. I basically help improve many plants. Not only that, in medicine. And then maybe or not won the Nobel Prize for it, too.
Well, yeah, it's good to set your sights a little high. I appreciate that. So, if you do win a Nobel Prize, can you send me a postcard and say thanks?
Yes.
Very cool. Well, very nice to meet you, and good luck with everything.
You too.
And here's another student who is participating in the program here at Oak Leaf. What were some of your highlights of the program?
I think the whole highlight of getting a certificate or a certification in the biotech industry, which I did receive, and the whole aspect of the science side of agriculture and learning more innovative ways to increase our food supply and how to grow new food or produce more plants, I think that's really cool, and I really liked it. It sparked my interest.
And so you're finishing high school now, and so what do you do next?
Next, I plan on attending a university, and I actually want to major in biotechnology because that program influenced me so much to pursue a career in biotechnology and agriculture. So I applied to other universities to expand my knowledge on it. So
it was one of those, University of Florida?
Yes, yes.
Ah, good answer. Where do you imagine you'll be in the future, like maybe, you know, 10 years from now?
I imagine myself working on a career or being in a career of either biotechnology or in agriculture, helping the world increase our food supply because we are running low on, like, farmland and stuff. So I hope to be one of those innovative people to create new ways, too.
Awesome. So I guess, you know, and you kind of stole my next question, is that with all the tools you in your toolbox and all the things you learned about with biotechnology, if there was one problem you could solve, what would you do first?
It would probably be like increasing the food and feeding the poor who don't have a lot of food and making new ways to where we can feed those people because we have enough food. It's just we need to get it over there.
That's a beautiful answer. Thank you so much for your time.
And there you have it. The ideas of students who are excited to take careers in the area of biotechnology, or at least using it as part of their toolbox to solve problems that they feel are really important. And that's one thing that I think is really another forward-thinking and optimistic edge of our current time. and that is students in high school, students in college, they do share a really strong sense of how they can contribute to help solve problems. And I think that's really exciting. I think it's quite different than even it was maybe 5 or 6 years ago. Certainly different than when I was a student. So thank you very much for the opportunity, and thank you for participating in the podcast. And right after this brief break, we'll come back with the interview on Terminator seeds with Dr. Mel Oliver from the USDA.
The Talking Biotech Podcast has one goal, and that's to get you excited about your food, new technologies, and the good things we can do when we put the two together. We live in a time of great innovation and discovery, yet the new findings are slow, oftentimes, to reach the public. And why is that? Because of the tremendous misunderstanding, coupled to a complacent population that would rather err to the side of caution rather than implement safe technology that can help farmers, consumers, and the planet. And that's why it's so important that you listen and share the stories of agricultural technology. That's why this podcast is important, because it provides you with access to the experts that tell the beautiful stories of genetic improvement of crops, animals, and medicines. So please make sure you complete a review on iTunes, share the podcast with a friend, listen to it around the dinner table, and share the stories of the secret lives of the botanical critters in each layer of that 7-layer salad. With your help, we can move agricultural innovation to application, and that happens with communication. We're all in this together to bring safe and affordable technologies that help our people and our planet.
My name is Chelsea Boonstra, and welcome to the Boonstra Report, where we talk about all things agriculture. Today on the Boonstra Report, I wanted to quickly talk about farming and the myths and rumors behind it. Many people assume dairy farmers are abusive and do not care about the animals and their health. Well, that is far from the truth. The videos you see on social media are staged, and they show you what they want the people to see. If you think we would get up between 2 and 4 a.m. to start our first milking for the cows, just for fun, well, you are quite wrong. This is a labor-intensive, as well expensive, job to have. It's also not just our job, it's a passion and way of life for us. Before stirring up the pot on social media that is not true, or even just sharing those horrific videos, please go watch The Real Truth About Family Farms, which I had made about our own operation, and you can find it on YouTube. As well, please be sure to follow me, Chelsea Boonstra, on Twitter, Instagram, and my Facebook page. Thanks so much, everyone.
Today on the Talking Biotech podcast, we have an opportunity to really delve into a little bit of myth-busting, a really overdue topic that people ask about all the time. And I was really excited to be able to connect with the expert who has some good insights into the ideas of what is framed familiarly in common discussion as Terminator genes. And I'll talk today with Dr. Mel Oliver from the Plant Genetics Research Unit with the USDA ARS stationed at the University of Missouri in Columbia, Missouri. Welcome to the podcast, Dr. Oliver.
Thank you. Nice to be here, Kevin.
Yeah, this is really a pleasure. I got to meet you in person last year, and I always look forward to having a discussion with you, and really glad we could do this. Could you tell us a little bit about your current position, though, at USDA and what you do for the state of Missouri and maybe for our national interests?
Yeah, actually, being a federal, we are pretty much national, although we do have some good Missouri context, because obviously often what's good for the nation is good for Missouri. I'm in charge of a plant genetics unit that focuses mainly on corn and soybeans with a little bit of wheat. We do a lot of trait improvement type of basic research. I have some scientists at the Danforth Center who are looking at some very complex issues such as G-by-E, which is gene by environment, interactions, as well as how carbon and nitrogen are fluxing through plant metabolism. Here in Colombia, we work mainly on seed quality improvement, as well as some of the more basic work involved in genetics, developing new ways of understanding maize genetics and soybean genetics. Myself, I'm interested in dehydration tolerance. I work both with maize and looking at root traits involved in the response to soil water deficits, and also looking at how plants respond to dehydration using resurrection plants, which is something I've been doing for almost 30 years now.
Your research today has lots of relevance to American agriculture, and it seems like a great fit for USDA. But if I go back 20 years and we talk about the way that some of the ideas of this idea of the Terminator gene, this discussion that I know that wasn't your terminology, but could you take us back to that time, what it was happening in the actual story that kind of prompted the conceptualization of this particular strategy?
Sure, yeah. At the time, I was working in Lubbock, Texas, in a unit that was basically looking at plant stress responses as well as cotton improvement. Obviously, Lubbock, Texas is right in the middle of the cotton belt. And at that time, we were just starting to see the revolution in cotton agriculture because of the large threat to the cotton industry by insects and weeds. And basically, the cotton industry was basically in trouble with lots and lots of attacks by insect pests. And so the issue was, at that time, was how do we protect cotton from insect pests, and how do we improve cotton agriculture within both the high plains of Texas and in the nation. So obviously in those days, back in the late 80s, early 90s, people were starting to think about biotech ways of doing that, and the companies had started to look at BT as a way of protecting plants from pests, and cotton was one of the first to be used as a source, as a target for BT introduction using genetic engineering, as was herbicide tolerance for glyphosate. And so when I was there, we were interested in the effect of that on agriculture. And a lot of concerns in those days were about the issue of can genes move from engineered plants into the natural environment. And in the case of cotton, that's kind of limited more to the south than where we were in Texas, but it was an overarching problem that we were looking at and was trying to figure out how we could better protect the environment from the escape of transgenes into wild species. And that was, you know, a real push by lots of the community in science and in plant biology, was to look at the safety of genetically engineered crops. And so the other issue at the time was, how does gene containment then improve the agriculture of seed introduction and crop varieties within the industries, within the seed industries, within the agricultural landscape. And basically, the increase in regulations on biotech and the understanding of what we knew that biotech was all about in those days meant that we had to look for ways that we could improve the ability to release engineered products into agriculture without affecting the environment, and also allowing it to, or the trait identity to be maintained, so that these crops could be followed and monitored and so on. And certainly there are lots of reasons why you want to, commercially, you want to keep your trait identity, apart from agricultural considerations, there are also commercial considerations. Okay. And that was how we got into this whole idea of how do we do that in an efficient way, because there are no real natural ways to... for gene containment, really. These are things that you have to design in an agricultural sense.
Right. Does that help? No, that's perfect. So, typically when we were talking about containment, we'd be thinking about maybe staggering flowering times of a transgenic, or I should say a genetically engineered and a non-genetically engineered crop in an adjacent field. Or maybe planting in ways where, and I know USDA looks at this very carefully upon applications, is making sure there are no feasible natural outcrossers. And those are things that people have always worried about in terms of, I shouldn't say worried about, but things that have always been taken into consideration when looking very seriously at the environmental impact of releasing a genetically engineered crop.
Absolutely. And certainly when you're looking at crops that have been engineered with BT, you know, part of the standards of that is that you have to maintain a refuge. And if you can contain the genes so that your refuge remains intact, then you have a much more effective control of the spread of resistance within the insect community.
So when we think back to that time, and this is, we're talking about like the 90s, and so it seemed like a really good idea to come up with some sort of systems to be able to ensure that the traits would stay where they belonged. And what was the original idea in terms of maybe a mechanism for containment?
Well, actually, that was kind of interesting. You know, we were interested in how you do this. We looked at lots of potential ways to do this. Most of them were not feasible. And at the time, I was working with a colleague in Lubbock, Norma Trolander, who was working with the Cree-Lox system, which is a system for site-specific recombination in DNA. And we were looking at that as a way of producing, making crossing easier using developing male sterols for breeding programs in cotton. And when we started to think about this, you know, how do we, could we use the Cree-Lox system in a way that would allow us to prevent the trans, or to remove the transgene? And in fact, that had been looked at quite extensively by others in USDA to look at how you would use Cree-Lox to remove a transgene from a plant. But that, in essence, is not gene containment in the sense that it's, you know, you have to have 100% efficiency, you have to have, you have to set that up in a farmer's field, which is obviously not possible. So We puzzled over this for a long time, and you know, this sounds very silly, but I actually woke up in one of those eureka moments you occasionally have. I woke up at 3 a.m. and said, "Ah, I know how to do this." And so that is sort of what we did. It's basically using very specifically timed natural promoters to allow for the production of a crop, so that you the farmer, when he plants the seed, will get a crop. But then, you know, anything that's produced from that crop, the seeds themselves, will not produce a second crop. And that was sort of how we developed the what we call GeneSafe, or we called it TPS, which was the Technology Protection System. And the reason it was called, we called it GeneSafe in ARS, but the company that we were working with at the time, which was Delta and Pineland Company, a cotton seed company, a small cotton seed company out of Mississippi, they called it the Technology Protection System because it allowed them to obviously put any technology that they put into the plant would be not so much protected, but would protect the environment.
Let me jump back just a moment to describe a couple of the points you touched on, just so the listener is right on board. When we talk about male sterility, why it's important in a breeding program is because mm-hmm. if you're producing male and female gametes, or the pollen and the ovules in adjacent structures, it makes it very hard for a breeder to be able to control what pollen goes onto that cross. And so if you have something that's male sterile, producing only a female portion of the plant, you can now introduce whatever pollen source you like and have 100% or close to 100% of a cross that you can control. And so the idea here was to be able to introduce a transgene that would induce the male sterility, but use Crelox, which is, as you mentioned, a recombination system, which enables, allows the pieces to be specifically removed. So in other words, Crelox would kind of self-recombine out the element that was installed, and this way not passing it on to the next generation. Is that about where we, do I have a good understanding of that?
Well, actually, you're mixing the two. The male sterile part is really you're using Crelox targeting mechanism to produce a plant that cannot produce pollen. So for the breeder, this is sort of common breeding practices, is that you have to go in there and hand emasculate, as we call it, which is a very frightening term, if you like, but it's basically you remove the male parts of the flower so that you can put on pollen of the desired cross so that you can produce the plants you wish. And that's a very time-consuming and labor-intensive operation. And so at the time, back in the 90s, there were lots of ways of developing male steriles in a way just for breeding programs. These were not something to be released at the time, but just in breeding programs to aid the breeder in producing plants. Now, the Crelox, using the Crelox system to actually remove genes was if you, the main focus of that was in the early days of plant genetic engineering. There were a lot of use of antibiotic marker genes that were in the constructs that were used to produce transgenic plants. And the idea was to use Crelox to remove those antibiotic genes out of the plant so that that wasn't carried through and that antibiotic gene would not be in the environment. Also, if you really did want to produce a non-transgenic plant from a transgenic plant, this was a way of doing that. But that was more of a research-based type of effort.
So we have mentioned that this was done with a company at the time with Delta and Pineland. Did they actually produce a plant with this technology, or what was this technology ever deployed? How close did it get?
No, it never did go out of my lab or out of greenhouse trials, if you like, because we never we had it working in tobacco quite early, and then we moved into cotton, and we were in the process of doing that. And then basically that effort, once the patent had been produced, the effort sort of went off because the technology we were using, our prototype, was not something that could go into commercial production. So we were working hard to, or the company was working hard to bring that into a more commercial thing. Because our prototype was never designed to do, it was designed to test the strategy, and the strategy works, but it was not something that you could use in a commercial sense. So the company, I did not go past the prototype stage, so it was never developed by the company as far as I know.
And so that was back in, what, late 90s?
Yeah.
And so I guess one of the major criticisms of genetic engineering is that, you know, we do worry about gene flow, or at least, you know, it's one concern we need to take into consideration. And, you know, just kind of just thinking about this, are there facets of this technology or these roots of this technology that could be really beneficial and really satisfy some of the concerns of some of the critics?
Oh, absolutely. It was, that was the whole design, was to make this a very successful way of preventing gene flow or movement of genes from a transgene into a wild population. And the strategies that we developed and others have looked at are very good at doing that. And, you know, some, I don't know how far they've got commercially. We did, there were some that were being looked at that way, but nothing like, you know, nothing based on the way that we did it, certainly not to produce seeds that would not germinate. There are different strategies other than that. But certainly nothing, there is nothing in the technology that did not suggest, or that suggested that it would not be very successful in preventing gene flow. And in fact, it could be used for other strategies for other purposes, such as perhaps preventing invasive species and stuff like this.
Yeah, I guess that would be my other thought, you know, in terms of ecological applications, you know, and ways that you could do good things with this particular line of thinking, but never really being developed past a kind of conceptualization stage and prototypes. Do you have any particular feelings when you hear folks roll this out here 20 years later and they say, you know, oh, this is what I hate about the technologies, it's all self-limiting? Anything like cross to your mind in terms of that, or do you just kind of roll your eyes? And
well, that's all you can do.
So thank you, Dr. Mel Oliver. This is a question that comes up over and over and over again in the discussion of genetic engineering and crop biology, and I really appreciate you taking the time to illuminate this for us today. Thank you so much.
My pleasure.
And there you have it, an authoritative view of what Terminator technology was and wasn't. And once again, a technology that never advanced really past the initial stages. Yet, if it would have come out in a different way, maybe if it was actually used, if we would have communicated about it up front and talked about it in a scientifically accurate way with experts like Dr. Oliver, where might it be today? And would it have been instrumental in mitigating one of the central comments are one of the central criticisms of biotechnology. So thank you very much for listening to today's podcast. I'm Kevin Folta, and as we move along through the season, I really hope that you take the time to be grateful for the goodness that agriculture brings us and the science and technology that goes into every bite on your plate. You can think of the farmers that grew it, the harvesters that picked it, the people who helped to process and move it through the supply chain. It took an awful lot for that food to get from a concept in a plant breeder's head to your dinner plate. And make sure you use everything wisely. Thank you very much, and we'll talk to you again next week.
Thank you for listening to the Talking Biotech podcast. Please send your suggestions for guests, comments, or questions to talkingbiotech@gmail.com. Please write a review on iTunes and recommend this podcast to a friend. More downloads and reviews raise the visibility of this podcast and help us reach a wider audience with science.